Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 367.
This week on the podcast, Trump is visiting the fire-ravaged West Coast and is in danger of being camouflaged by the color of the air.
And the Rhode Island primary becomes the sleeper hit of the season.
Plus, Bernie suggests a proven winning strategy to Biden, so he'll most certainly be blamed for his loss.
And Mitch McConnell's coronavirus relief bill is the definition of insanity.
Plus, Bob Woodward gives us the proof that we didn't need that Trump is gaslighting us on COVID.
And Trump looks to be a lock for the Nobel Prize for misspellings.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right.
Guys,
you can catch us trying to breathe the air right now.
You won't catch me trying to breathe the air. I am doing everything I can to avoid breathing the air. I have not been outside in days. It is getting a little dull in here.
I'm sure.
Tried learning to play the ukulele because it's the only thing I haven't tried yet in quarantine.
Right, you've entered that stage.
I've entered a stage of quarantine that I didn't know I was expecting to have to enter because we were just getting to the point where we were like, well, we've got to learn to live with quarantine, so let's learn to figure out what we can and can't do.
Right, we'll go do this with our friends once a week, and we'll just wear masks, and we'll make sure to do the things that we're doing, and we're going back to the stores, and California's opened some things back up for you to do, and it's like, maybe we shouldn't be doing that, but like,
you got to live your life. But then I was reminded of why we all owned N95 masks to begin with, and then got shamed about by East Coasters. Because early on in the pandemic, I kept asking friends, no, wait, but do the N95s help? Are you just saying they don't help because we want to reserve them for doctors? Like, you know, early on when we were all lying about masks and no one knew the truth. Yeah. And my doctor friends on the East Coast kept saying, you shouldn't have N95 masks. And I was like, no, you have to have them in California. The air is bad here. We have fires. And they just didn't understand. And now, look who has the last laugh. Not me, because I only have shitty N95 mask.
Certainly not us.
And now you can't buy another one, so.
Yeah.
It's like I've been double masking if I do have to go outside at all, like to get my mail and stuff.
Yeah, I have one of those ones that is like a cloth mask, but it has like the insert for you to like put an actual filter in. And for a while, I had not been putting the filter in because it was just kind of like a pain. And
quite
it's
time,
like, who cares? But now I'm definitely got the living that filter life.
Oh, yeah. We're living the filter life here. Hardcore. Yeah. I'm also living the air filter inside life. I'm living the air conditioner is on all day, even though it's too cold life. I mean, that life. And we don't even have it the worst on the West Coast.
No. Like,
by far. And some places that I feel like normally are famous for their clear air are who have it the worst. Because it's like in Portland and Seattle that have really been getting the brunt of this. Now, I would contend that the one thing that they have that we don't have is the potential for rain.
That's true. It's not going to rain here anytime.
Never going to rain here. So the fire isn't going to be dissipated by rain, whereas at least I think next week they're hoping for rain in the Pacific Northwest, which would help tamp down on some of, certainly help clear the air a bit, but also, you know, get some of these fires under control. We're starting to hear, you know, news about the death toll from these fires, which it's now over 30, but Oregon has been talking about some sort of mass fatality incident. So we don't know what that is. And it sounds
I think it's hard to know the death toll right now because there have been so many people who have had to evacuate and there's so many people who are missing and unaccounted for, but that is in large part due to some of the evacuations.
Right.
So we don't really know what that number is right now, but certainly if you assume that at least a chunk of the people who we know are also missing, then like the death count is much more than 30, but it seems like it could be much more than we might even be guessing right now.
Yeah.
And it's in nowhere near, you know, these are not getting more contained as we go either. So
And also this is only the beginning of fire season. We haven't really had the Santa Anas kick in yet. And then on top of that, this is not accounting for what will inevitably be a lot of long-term health consequences from this kind of prolonged smoke exposure, because the smoke I've never experienced anything like what we're experiencing here.
Well, it hasn't been this bad in over 30 years, apparently, in
Los
Angeles. And that wasn't due to fire. That was just smog.
Right, smog.
So this is actually I mean, smog isn't great for you, but this, like, you really has a very visceral feel to the air, like, when you go outside. Like, you can feel it.
And this is not even as bad as it is in a lot of the West Coast, so, no. I mean, it, like...
I think Portland now has the...
the worst air
air quality in the world, and they're followed by San Francisco and Seattle. So you mentioned them, but, like, that's how bad they are. They're those are the top three in the world right now in terms of bad air quality.
I think LA is only in the top 10.
Yeah, and we've all seen pictures of, you know, what the air looks like in China and various places. Like, you know, so to think of some of those pictures that you've seen. Los Angeles has had a real roller coaster here, because remember when we had the best air quality in the world at the beginning of this when everybody stopped driving?
I know. It's been like a real... I have not been able to keep up.
From hero to zero.
It's so fast. Yeah, these fires... First of all, they've now burned a land area that is the size of New Jersey. It is likely that these are not the only fires we're going to experience this season. So this is going to be an ongoing issue. And I think one thing that we all know about the fires is that they were not caused by us not raking our forests correctly. But Donald Trump is he's the person who invented that theory, the forest raking theory. And so I feel Donald Trump is coming here tomorrow to California to, I don't know, probably make our lives more miserable by insulting us. And I'm curious to see whether that theory still holds for him. I'm curious to see whether he is angry at us about the fires as opposed to himself, a person who's not providing us adequate federal support. I'm curious to find out if he has a new conspiracy theory about how forest fires are caused that we might need to subscribe to now.
And what I would say is, if he actually thinks that it's the lack of raking, then send us some rakers.
There's an easy solution to the raking problem.
I think we're ready to try anything at this point.
Exactly.
You know?
One thing,
let's pretend maybe that's the actual problem, and then if it is, like, let's have a solution to it. Right. I mean, it's a ridiculous thing to do, but I mean, like...
At least put
your money where your mouth is. You know what I mean? Like,
we finally did one thing that puts our money where our money is, because we had, for years, been forcing inmates to be firefighters here. So a lot of our firefighting force, especially in fire season, was made up of inmates, and then they would be barred from becoming firefighters after, by the way, and this is the part that incenses, I mean, there's a lot of this that incenses me and everyone. One of the things that really incenses me about this was that means that the state trained all of these people to be firefighters and then was refusing to make good on our investment by allowing them to fight fires later. It was a waste of taxpayer dollars. And so if you are a person who doesn't care about people at all, then at least care about taxpayer dollars being wasted on a dumb program that meant that 40% of our firefighting force
had no long-term benefit.
Right, was being eliminated from the firefighter pool. So in any case, finally this week, Newsom signed a bill to remove some of the obstacles for inmates who were being barred because of their records from becoming firefighters.
They had a record, and because of that, weren't able to be, like, trained to be an EMT, and some of these things that were, like, prerequisites to actually be able to be a firefighter.
Yeah, it was a sneaky kind of bar, too, because they couldn't meet the prerequisites to become a firefighter.
It wasn't technically that they couldn't be firefighters. It was that they couldn't go through, they couldn't get some of the specific certifications that would, allow them to do it. So, that's good that we've been able to do that, because now, like you said, we've trained people to be firefighters. Now we can let them continue to be firefighters.
Right. Well, and it also, it seems like a win-win, because then it's like, you know, people are much less likely to be up to criming if they have, like, a job that pays their bills.
That's what I was going to say. Now they can go basically straight into the workforce. I mean, I think they still have to go through the proper training to, like, be, like, technically a firefighter, even though they've kind of already done it. But, I think this is going to help recidivism rates.
Yeah. I mean, I would think so.
Yeah. So also, good work.
Spend lots of money training firefighters. First of all, don't make inmates fight fires.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, that's your what this is really. Prior to this being signed the other day, and still to a certain degree, what this is slave labor.
That's right. Slave labor.
Call it what it is.
In a field that is incredibly dangerous, and also vital to public safety. Like, firefighting is a thing we should invest in. We shouldn't be using slave labor to fight fires. Not only because it's not fair to the people fighting the fires, but also just because this is, like, an ongoing need we are always going to have. So we should have an appropriate firefighting force. In any case, that's the the news from here, which is the only thing that you can think about, because when you look outside, the air is like brown and smoky.
Yeah.
But we finally, today was the first day that we could sort of see the sun a little bit.
Yeah.
You could, up until today, look directly at the sun. I've been using, my personal daily air quality test is, can I look directly at the sun? And if the answer is yes, then I don't go outside that day. And if the answer is only for a second, I still don't go outside that day. But I feel like tomorrow I might be ready to go outside if you can still see the sun. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. We shall see.
But we had some exciting primaries last week.
Yeah, which, who knew? We hadn't, you know, we talked about the Massachusetts primary for 6 weeks leading to the Massachusetts primary, and we told you nothing about the Rhode Island primaries.
No.
And it turns out we should have, I guess.
Well, here's the thing, is nobody knows what's going on in Rhode Island, and also their state government, they are like Massachusetts to some extent, but worse because there's no scrutiny, are like a heavy machine politics state, and they are also, so the reason I knew that something was going on in Rhode Island is because they have one of the nation's strictest voter ID laws, certainly for Democratic state, and one of the only voter ID laws that was proposed and passed by Democrats. And so I was tuned into this one race against the guy who proposed that legislation in the state Senate. But sort of thinking, you know, he had this progressive challenger. She was great, this candidate, Tiara Mack. And I was just sort of thinking, like, there's no way she's going to win this, but it's great that we're getting in there. And she won.
She won.
And not only did she win, but like tons of progressives won in statewide primaries
against, over the place.
And this is a state where the Democratic Party in Rhode Island has been, you know, a lot of their longtime incumbents are people who have very long conservative track records.
Yeah.
You know, Harold Metz, who's the candidate who sponsored the voter ID law, who is now has now been ousted. He's also pro-life. I mean, these are Democrats in name only in a lot of cases.
Well, for sure. I mean, part of the, you know, one of the leaders of one of the progressive groups who was working on this there said the first thing that they were going to do was to make sure that the moderate Dems in the state house didn't go through with their plans to basically cut all the money for austerity in the state budget. So that's what Democrats in the Rhode Island state budget are planning, or in the state legislature right now are planning. They're planning on austerity.
This is a state, by the way, that is up to political shenanigans in general. This is the state of Lincoln Chafee.
Right.
I mean, this is a state that doesn't have a political, doesn't know its political identity. It's a state that was built on slave money. It's a state where they're constantly having to figure out what to do because everything is named after famous slave importers. and so it's a state with like a really unique political culture. And a love of sort of fake aristocracy.
Yeah.
And because of that, a love of incumbency that has had a lot like what was going on in state government in New York State has not had the kind of scrutiny it deserves. And because of that, no one's really been paying attention to how conservative the Democrats there really are.
And there's so many things to love about this, because obviously you're excited that so many progressives won, but just the way in which they won, I think, is also really exciting to me, because there were a couple, first off, it was a real coordinated like group effort among some progressive groups there to make sure that they had candidates running and to really make sure that there was like a grassroots movement that like had the volunteers that did the door knocking. And there were a few groups that sort of were both working together and then also just sort of like, you know, separately to push their own candidates and to make sure that these guys were winning statewide. There's this group called the Rhode Island Political Cooperative, which was started in 2018 specifically in order to like form a strong progressive coalition in the state house. And they had 8 candidates who they were supporting win in these races. And then there was also this group called Reclaim Rhode Island, which was started by a bunch of ex-Sanders volunteers in the state. And they had 4 candidates specifically that they were pushing that won primaries. And most of them were, you know, running on Medicare for All and a Green New Deal. And they also supported one incumbent who was for those things, who had what everybody thought was going to be like a fairly stiff challenge from their right.
Well, and keep in mind that in a lot of these seats, the seats themselves are safe Democratic seats. So because of that, the primary was sort of the major race of the season for a lot of these state level offices.
Yeah. And I think they all, another thing that is exciting to me is that they really sort of, I think, proved, you know, certainly on a small scale, because there's not that many voters anyway in Rhode Island, but they certainly proved that having candidates like this to be excited about really does drive turnout.
Yeah.
And they worked hard to drive turnout. And considering sort of the world in which we're living right now, to be able to say that they had higher turnout than three of the last five presidential elections in the state, when there literally was no one running statewide. I mean, this was only local politics right here. I mean, there was neither of their Senate candidates.
We're talking
had a
about districts where the final vote counts were things like 2,500 votes to 600 votes or that
right
sort of thing.
Right. So the idea that they could drive that much voting in a year where there was nothing that would be classically thought of as interesting going on, I think really sort of like you can point to this as like a look, there were candidates that weren't duds to vote for.
That's
and
right.
So people decided that they would vote for them.
Yeah, that's often all it takes.
Right. I mean.
And that brings us to our next story.
Yeah. Oh, one more thing on that.
Oh,
sorry.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say the other thing, last thing that I think is exciting about this, because so many progressives won statewide, the co-chair of, I think it was Reclaim Rhode Island, also put their two senators on watch.
Yes.
He was like, Jack Reed and Sheldon Whitehouse should be paying close attention to this crystal clear message that Rhode Island voters have sent this week, an unambiguous progressive message. So they are not stopping at taking over the state house in Rhode Island.
Nor
and I don't think
they
should, especially considering, you know, how many votes you really ultimately need to move a primary here.
Yeah.
You know? I mean,
no, well, that's the thing is, like, local elections are a great level to get involved in because you, first of all, a lot of these seats are really cheap. You don't need to fundraise a huge amount of money to be a player in a lot of these races. And then you don't need to move that many votes.
Yeah.
And so you actually can do, like, real retail style politics where you actually go and, you know, try to call everyone in the district or try to shake hands with people. Like, these are things that you can actually accomplish in small states. It's a lot harder in states like California where, you know, our senators are about as reachable by us as our president is. But in a state like Rhode Island, I mean, you know, very little investment goes a long way.
Yeah. So exciting. Good work, Rhode Island.
Yeah. Who knew that we'd ever talk about Rhode Island?
Right.
So who had any thoughts about that?
Yeah.
But in any case, so my speaking of which was that...
Yes, your segue that I so rudely interrupted.
That's
fine.
My segue was to a story that came out this week. It was Washington Post that or Politico or one of them that first reported it. But that privately Bernie Sanders has been expressing some concerns about Joe Biden's presidential campaign. Now, look, they're the same concerns we've been expressing to you. They're not secret private concerns.
No.
They're the concerns that they're, you know, the Biden campaign isn't campaigning on any issues that really that people care about, that historically move votes for Democrats. And instead, they're sort of campaigning on a general sense that he's a nice guy and won't change anything. And Sanders, rightfully, is in private, at least theoretically, according to this reporting, trying to point that out to them. And also noting that Biden is also... You know, he's not campaigning with any of the people that are popular to younger voters. And you know that when younger voters don't show up for him, they're going to be like, oh, you can't trust younger voters. And it's going to be like, I don't know. You didn't ask younger voters to vote for you. So you repeatedly told them you don't care about them. So I don't know what to tell you about that.
Yeah.
But so the Sanders campaign, I think, kind of leaked some concerns in hopes that we could
I think
start
they
to
did too. It
move,
was people
move
you know,
some
was,
of these Biden
it
folks.
Was like three or four people who had like knowledge of secret talks that like spoke on the condition of anonymity, but like clearly this wasn't an accident that the story got into the press.
No, I think it's like what you know what the left is always trying to do and what we've been talking about where you have to, you know, we're all like, okay, hey, we're over here, like come find us over here. You're not going to get votes from our coalition if you don't come over here at all. If all you do is stick your tongue out at over here, then you won't get votes from over here.
Yeah.
And I think the Biden campaign has been really sort of ludicrously out of touch on this particular issue. It is possible to thread the needle such that you do not seem like a socialist. And by the way, they were going to call him a socialist no matter what. So I don't know why not be one. But you also, you do have to speak to your whole coalition. You can't repeat every day he says something that's not just not aligned with progressive voters, but is insulting to them. And then they, you know, and they're shocked why they're not polling well with some of the groups that the Sanders coalition was polling really well with.
I know. And I just don't, you know, I think the reason that he's not wanting to do this is because he doesn't want, you know, he's never going to go around with AOC.
No.
And while I think that that would probably be a huge boon to him, like I can wrap my head around like why he's not doing that, because they're already talking about how he's the Trojan horse for socialism. And we all know that that's crazy, certainly. Yeah. But like there are people who will believe that if he's photographed next to AOC, like, fine, it's ridiculous, but like I'll let him have it. But like you can still talk about these issues in a way that doesn't make you sound that way. And that is what I think is so insane, because, you know, you and I were talking before the podcast, like this in so many ways is how this is proven. We have a proven formula here, because it's in so many ways how we won the House in 2018 by talking about
healthcare,
like kitchen table issues,
talking
in a way that like didn't necessarily sound like socialism. You know, we talked about wages. We talked about continuing to be able to have access to healthcare. We talked about
prescription drug costs.
We talked about raising the minimum wage, which polls at like nearly 70%. You know, you can hit those issues and make them sound populist while not making them sound like
radical.
You're trying to turn us into Venezuela, which is what you're going to be accused of.
Right.
Like, there's a way to do both.
Well, and I think the calculated risk here is that. Or it's not, I mean, they're making a calculated risk that's based on a false pretense, because it doesn't matter what he says, the right's going to accuse him of being a socialist.
Well, right.
So if he's going to use that as an excuse to not say anything that could get his own voters to the polls, but he's going to be called that on the right anyway, and right-wing voters are going to believe that anyway, who has he actually won?
Yeah, no one, right.
There's zero people.
Yeah.
And also, if ever there was a time to talk about climate change...
Hello.
It would be when the sky is orange in the entire Western United States.
Earth is on fire. If you want to move some young votes right now, I got a way to do it for you.
Yeah. And look, he's started to talk a little bit about the environment. What I want to say is that I have been racking my brain this week trying to figure out, in a moment like this, why the Green New Deal isn't a non-controversial centrist Democratic policy. It is the most... It is literally a jobs investment that partners with an environmental investment. It's not a radical proposal. It's not socialism. It's actually exactly the kind of policy that the Democratic Party is famous for back when they did anything for enacting. And
it's a jobs policy. That's why they're calling it the Green New Deal,
exactly.
Because that's what the New Deal was.
It's a jobs program that is also a green program. I just like the idea that that isn't something he can embrace.
I know, and he has done that. I remember talking on this podcast after he gave his, because he did give a climate speech, and he has moved on the climate, on his own climate plans a little bit.
Well, the idea that we're
having
to move him is crazy.
Well, it is, but what I don't understand is why this has not just become a thing that like he hammers on when he goes out into the world. And I think that's what people are upset about, because like we know that he has a climate plan. We know that he also is like vaguely in favor of raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Like, we know that he has some of these plans, and he has also, you know, given speeches on some of them. But it just doesn't seem to be what he's making, like these economic issues. And look, we know those are the issues. Not only did they work in 2018, I mean, you know, we all know that it's the economy, stupid slogan.
Right.
Especially. Right, and especially when there's, you know, what, however many tens of million people that are unemployed right now, and however many millions are long-term unemployed right now. I mean, we talked about those numbers last week.
Right.
Like, why you would not have that be the cornerstone of every single thing that comes out of your fucking face in the world in which we live right now. I mean, we talked about this during the convention. Like, why he didn't talk about that during the convention is beyond me. But why he has continued to not do it over the last 3 weeks continues to be beyond me. It would work.
Yeah. No, it would work, and it wouldn't require him to move on anything.
No, he's there. He's just out waffling around about, you know, Trump being lying about this or doing
the things
that we know that Trump has been doing for the last 4 years anyway.
And every time that he does make a policy statement that breaks through that noise, it's the opposite of a progressive policy. You know, the things that break through the noise are that he doesn't want to defund the police and maybe even wants to increase police hiring. It's that he would veto Medicare for All. It's that he doesn't support the Green New Deal. He supports environmental policy
similar to
the Green New Deal, but not the Green. Like, it's
I think this week his didn't his campaign this week say that they weren't interested in cutting the Pentagon budget?
Yeah. No, exactly. Every policy discussion that breaks through the noise is a conservative Republican talking point. And he won't address any of these issues that are broadly popular with his base and specifically would be popular with some of the voting groups that they're not, you know, that they need to pick up some votes in. I mean, they're pulling their hair out trying to figure out why they're polling so terribly with Latino voters.
I know. Right.
And it's like, Latino voters were famously very jazzed about Sanders in this cycle, first of all. So the fact that you have not only disavowed all of that policy, but promised to veto most of it is not great. But on top of that, you know, your campaign didn't prioritize these voters. You've known you've had issues with Latino voters this whole time. He's never pulled well with Latino voters. And so it's not why we're talking about it 50 days before the election when he could have had a plan in January is beyond us anyway. But I mean, on top of that, you know, he didn't bring on any of the talent that helped the Sanders coalition build that support among Latino voters, that helped any candidate build that support among Latino voters.
He
snubbed Julian Castro at the convention, and then he hired a Republican to do his Latino voter outreach. And let me tell you,
it's not
hiring
working.
A Republican is not working. It's not even working with Cuban voters, who should be the only people it works with.
I was going to say, if a Republican was going to move you votes anywhere, it would be Florida, and he's losing them there.
Exactly. And he's
losing them everywhere, actually. He's polling worse with the Latino voters than Hillary Clinton. Think about that. Think about the last 4 years, what the last 4 years have looked like for Latino voters in this country. I mean, literally, children caged at the border.
Yeah.
Right? And he's doing worse than Hillary Clinton was 4 years ago with Latino voters. That is almost impressive.
It's a feat, and I think what's going to happen and what I'm going to be very frustrated by is it's a feat that they're going to blame on the voters when it is actually their responsibility to make the pitch.
Right.
That's, I think they have this sort of entitled brand of campaigning that makes it seem like they don't owe voters the pitch. And that's just not right. That's not how it works.
And also, I'm going to tell you what else is going to happen. There's going to be a lot of Biden voters, people who helped him get the nomination, who are also going to be shocked as if they didn't know the first time around. And I got news for you. I will be someone who will not be shy about telling them.
I'm not going to be gracious.
I used
up all my grace.
I am not going to let a Biden voter be shocked that the Latinos did not vote for him. That's not a thing that I'm going to be messing around with.
And that's coming from Brent Thornburg, a person who's wearing an Amy Klobuchar t-shirt right now.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, I'm wearing that for two reasons. One, mostly because I need to do laundry desperately, if we're being honest. But also,
I had a lot of t-shirts from candidates we would not vote for that we got in our various caucus travels.
Right. It was like either wear this Amy Klobuchar t-shirt or wear a John Delaney t-shirt.
Right.
And I got to thinking to myself, as I was choosing between those two t-shirts, which one I was going to wear, knowing that I might have to be seen in it during this podcast, in case you're watching this on YouTube, is because the shirt is, I will show it to you if you are watching on YouTube, it says Amy Klobuchar will beat Donald Trump. And it says a lot of nonsense on the back. It has too many words.
I'm going to read you all the words it has on the back, because I think it's important you get the full picture of how this shirt, the reason we took these shirts was because they were so funny, because they were like
they
the
were
most comically overloaded shirt that we've ever seen in history.
It was the we got them for free while we were watching the Super Bowl party with Amy Klobuchar.
Here's what the back says. A president for all of America, ranked most effective Democratic senator, raised 100 plus bills as lead Democrat, turned 42 Trump counties blue in 2018, wins big in the Midwest, Amy for America. I was not able to say all of that in one breath.
Right, that's all on the back of the shirt.
If you're watching on YouTube, I will hold it up for you, because I also have one. I mean, that's a shirt that's too many words for one shirt.
Yeah.
That's a paragraph.
But I got to thinking, because I knew we were going to be talking about these two stories on the podcast, the Sanders talking about the Biden campaign and Biden struggling with Latinos. Like, I think Amy Klobuchar would be beating Donald Trump right now. And look, Joe Biden is also beating Donald Trump right now. I mean, we're taking him to task for things that I think we rightly are taking him to task for.
Yeah.
He's
not
still
beating him impressively.
Right. Right, exactly. But I got to thinking, you know, Amy Klobuchar is a person who co-sponsored the Green New Deal resolution in Congress. She is a person who I think would have been smart enough to know that she was immediately upon entering the general election, had work to do with people of color.
Yeah.
There, I think that she has the type of, knows the type of language, you know, being that sort of like, you know, hometowny Midwestern sort of person who would be able to sort of like speak the language that we're wanting Biden to speak right now in the way of like sounding like a populist without really actually
promising
being
anything.
One or yeah. promising anything or sounding like a socialist or anything. Like, I just feel like upon glancing at that shirt in my closet and then reading both of these two stories, it just, it put me into a dark place briefly, because I just sort of like, I go back to like, we have entrusted the one person who could actually figure out how to lose this election
yeah.
to be the person that we need to win it.
And look, we're not supposed to talk about it.
Right, we're not, yeah, exactly.
Which is even worse, because it means that we can't address the problem. You know, like,
yeah, right.
The fact that we're not allowed to talk about it does not promise that no one knows. You know, like, I think there's a sense among Biden voters that, like, no one knows he's a terrible candidate because we just aren't saying it. And, right. like, that's not actually the case.
No, right, we the all case, knew. Everyone knew.
Wants
a lot
to
of people who
Donald
voted for him knew.
Right, everyone wants to defeat Donald Trump. We're all worried about how we're going to accomplish this. And
right.
in endeavoring to do that, we are worried that a person who not only is not able to, I mean, Biden specifically is not able to apologize for his mistakes and often not able to acknowledge his mistakes, and now his whole campaign seems to be operating on that basis, is really a troubling place to have left all of us. It's a place where Brent looked at his closet and thought, yeah, Amy Klobuchar would have beat Donald Trump. And that's not a place you want to be in.
It's not. Right?
We don't have to tell like you that we
don't
want
to be pining
Amy Klobuchar
for the days
be...
of Amy Klobuchar. Like,
no.
That's not it.
That's a dangerous cocktail you've created for yourself. So I feel like honor Brent's sacrifice by thinking about how to think critically about Biden so that we can make sure that he wins, but also doesn't... I think the other concern that I have is that he takes the wrong message from him winning, which would be a win against all odds and against all of the odds of his terrible campaigning. Like, if he wins, it's not because they ran a smart campaign. It's because people really, really don't want Donald
right.
Trump to be the
and
president.
And it wasn't because he moved enough
Republicans,
you know,
to vote
Republicans.
For him. Right.
Yeah.
It's just because people are freaking out. I worry yeah. that they will think that this is a validation of what was the world's most dangerous campaign tactic.
Right.
And that they will continue to employ that campaign tactic in the future and then wonder how the votes didn't materialize. When
yeah.
millennials, who have not been addressed at any point in this process, don't turn out for them in the future. And by the way, the Anand's newsletter last week was about how underrepresented millennials are in Congress, because Joe Biden became a senator when he was 30 years old.
Yeah.
We don't have any millennial senators right now.
No, I think the median age in the Senate is in the 60s.
Yeah. There is not a single millennial senator in the Senate right now. So...
Yeah.
That just goes to show you that this demographic that they are ignoring in their candidacies is also not represented anywhere else. We have
right.
a couple of people in Congress, and that's about
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
so I that's not a sustainable winning strategy
no,
for Democrats.
There are some good signs
right.
going into the election.
One maybe good sign.
Maybe good signs.
I have,
we don't know.
I'm skeptical about how... this is a good sign. I'm just skeptical about how good it is.
Yes, and I think that there's a couple reasons why they could be, like, false flag good signs also.
Yeah.
But the Dems are definitely winning in some battleground states in ballot requests.
Yeah. Requesting absentee ballots is
yes.
a largely Democratic game at the moment.
Yes, it is.
They're...
So, but that is always the case. Early
yeah.
voting is always done by Democrats. Same-day voting is always done by Republicans. So,
yeah. And
that's the reason why I think you have to take this into account.
Mid-pandemic, where Republicans don't believe the virus is real and Democrats do, I think you're
right.
likely
Republicans
to
are
going to
vote in a polling place only just to prove a point about their
right.
lack of care about the coronavirus.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. The good signs are that in a lot of battleground states, the Democrats are really trouncing Republicans in ballot requests. They're
yeah.
out requesting them 3-1 in North Carolina, in Florida.
And Pennsylvania.
I think, and in Pennsylvania, in Florida, which Trump has to win. I think the Democratic lead for ballot requests is something like 700,000 ballots. They're leading
yeah.
in New Hampshire, Iowa, Ohio. And in some states, they are also, there are a lot of Democrats who sat out the last race have requested ballots. So
yeah, I like think a ton, like 175,000
in Pennsylvania in particular.
That is the difference right there for sure. I mean, he lost by, I think, like 10 or 20,000 votes
exactly.
in Pennsylvania.
So that's a good sign. Now, these might be people who just don't vote in midterms very often, because I don't know what
last. But they didn't vote in 2016.
They didn't vote in presidential election. They didn't vote. Oh, these are presidential ballots.
Yeah.
I'm hopeful about those statistics for sure.
Yes.
And I think this is a good time to remind everyone that the sort of count that you see on election day could change.
Right.
Everything's going to look different this year. It's going to be like living in California, where two weeks later we're like not sure who won any of the elections. So it will probably, because of the crush of same day voting that Republicans are going to do, it will look like Donald Trump has a huge lead on election day. And I think it's going to be hard to untangle that narrative.
I agree. I think it's right for us to be hitting that. And I think Biden has also been hitting that. A lot of Democrats are like warning against that. I also, yes, is there going to be way more mail-in voting this year? Of course.
Yeah.
I also feel like by the time November rolls around, unless something changes about the state we're in right now, I feel like most people are, not most, I feel like there's still going to be a ton of same-day voting by both parties. You know, like, I don't intend to same-day vote, but I intend to vote in person, even though I'm going to have a ballot at my house. I think a lot of people are sort of going to look at, like, their daily activities and be like, well, it's not more dangerous for me to go vote than it is for me to go to Target.
One
like,
thing that you can do, request a ballot, because you can always drop off your ballot in person, and that's safer than sitting at a polling place for 100 hours.
And that'll get counted with the ballots on the day.
Gets counted with the ballots.
So, or before, if you drop it out before. Many places you can drop it off beforehand.
Exactly. So if you vote early, it's okay to vote by mail. It's okay to fill out your ballot early and just drop it at a polling place. Don't feel like just because Brent is talking about voting in person that you have to do
that. Like that you have to do that. And if you don't feel comfortable, then you absolutely should feel okay voting by mail. But
it's a good reason to vote early, though, which I would not normally recommend, which is, I think, been sort of a transition for me in this cycle is normally I'm very much a vote on the day person because I like to know what's going to happen up until the day. You know, sometimes you have late breaking revelations about candidates. Sometimes a scandal happens. Sometimes, you know, something weird happens and a James Comey type thing happens and you want to know going in what the deal is. Not that we needed to know about the James Comey thing. That was the only thing that came to mind. That didn't help anything. But I would say in this environment, it's worth taking the risk of
people are going to vote early. At their earliest possible convenience, I think, this year, with no care about what happens in the month after their ballot comes in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you should also, in California and in a lot of places, and now in New York City, you can also track your ballot so you can make sure that your vote counted. Yeah. Because the other thing that you can do is if your ballot was rejected for any reason, you can find out before election day so that you can go and cast a provisional ballot.
That is
something to think about. In any case,
yes,
that's an exciting sign, or it means nothing, the ballot request thing. We're just bringing you facts that you can ignore or not.
It's certainly better than that not being the case.
Well, exactly.
Right?
It's better than it being worse.
Right. I also just hope that it doesn't give people a false sense of security in the way that would then make them think that maybe it's not super important that they vote anyway.
We are doing a lot of things messaging wrong the Democrats and everyone. The first being, I think undermining everyone's trust in the mail is a terrible idea right now. I think we should, because the mail-in ballots are going to be the easiest way for people to vote in this cycle, we should not be going around talking about how it's not going to work. Like, I think we can talk about there's other ways to vote if you want to. If you want to feel that your ballot's definitely going to be counted, you can do X, Y, and Z, whatever. But, like, the Democrats keep going on about how terrible voting is going to be. And it's like, well, no one's going to do it if it's going to be so awful.
Right.
They're going on about how it's going to be, there are going to be terrible lines in person, and the mail doesn't work, and you know, like, it's like there's no good way to vote.
Right, it just turns people off.
It turns people off to voting. So I think the thing to do is to give people instructions about how to vote, not to tell them that voting is going to be super hard.
I agree. Let Trump do that, and because there are a lot of I've been reading a lot of reports about Republicans privately wishing that he wasn't doing that because they're afraid that he's going to do the same thing that you just talked about to
own
voters. Like, let Trump scare. Let Trump scare Republicans about how terrible mail-in voting is, and then let them not vote. Like,
right.
We should continue to tell people how great and wonderful the act of voting is.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think we're so our messaging is, like, really off because we're going on about how important it is to vote, but with one hand, and then on the other, we're like, but it's going to be so hard.
Right.
It's going to be so hard, and it might not work. Like, don't have that be a situation.
Yeah.
Just read the instructions.
Yeah, that's it.
Just read the instructions. In any case, if you were thinking, hey, one benefit of having an election is that maybe people in Congress will want to feel like they're serving their constituents and will pass a new relief bill before November, just know that the world doesn't work anymore. Nothing is work. Logic is not a thing anymore. The logical thing to do, which would be to give people money in their pockets so that they would be like, we love those Republicans because they gave us all this money just now, is not the logic of the world that we live in. The world that we live in is basically people proposing bills that the other side will never agree to and then acting scandalized when they don't pass and then not passing anything even though everyone is starving.
I know. It's insane because you'll remember that the Democrats months and months and months ago passed the HEROES Act, which we told you all the reasons why it was terrible. But it still was like $3 trillion and like all, those $3 trillion, at least in most cases, were going to things that were like appropriate to go to. It was not enough in some cases and then also was in some cases like too much going to private health insurance companies, like to pay for people's COBRA. So it wasn't perfect. But look. $3 trillion was too much for the Republicans. So Mitch McConnell thought to himself, this was months ago, I know, we'll come up with a $1 trillion plan.
Right.
And at that point, the Democrats were like, no, this is hogwash. This isn't enough. We need to do more. And so they went on recess and then came back. And Mitch McConnell thought, hey, I know, that $1 trillion bill was not enough for them. So I'll put forward a $300 billion plan.
That's right.
I'll slash it by a third.
And then I'll be shocked right. when it doesn't pass.
that the Democrats killed it.
And by the way, just in case you were running out of things to worry about, they also have to fund the government by the end of the month. So, like, they are not going to get to this.
Yeah.
So this is, like, a bad faith proposal that Mitch McConnell puts to a cloture vote. It doesn't pass. Rand Paul actually votes with the Democrats.
It had a penny in it.
Right.
That's why
exactly, because they were giving money to people. and then everyone is now walking around acting scandalized. The bill would have bolstered unemployment benefits by $300 because people were just living too large on that $600.
Yep.
But that was the amount that Trump put in that FACO executive order that may or may not be constitutional. But then it included something that they knew was a non-starter for Dems and should be a non-starter for all people, which is liability protections for businesses, hospitals, churches, and schools against COVID-related personal injury claims. This is something that the business community is trying to pass so that when they force people to return to work, or invite people into their churches and schools, they can't be sued when it turns out everyone has coronavirus later and dies of it. We should not give people that liability protection.
No, that cannot make it in that any cannot form of
make
final
it
bill.
Into any form of final bill. So they included that. That's a definitive non-starter for the Democrats.
Yeah.
They included a second round of loans for the Paycheck Protection Program. I have a hard time saying that every single time. And they included $10 billion for the Postal Service, but they were going to have to do a lot of accounting for that $10 billion. Yes. And then they were going to give $105 billion to...
A third of it, by the way. That's a third of this the whole bill.
To an education stabilization fund, which is basically just fucking taxpayer money for school choice. It was to give money to... You know, that could go to like private schools and scholarship granting organizations. It was a tax credit for them so that they could, I guess, continue their work of funneling taxpayer money into private education programs. But that money, that means that of the one third of the bill that they devoted to education funding, a lot of it goes to just private education, school choice related policy.
Tax
and
credits.
Very little of it goes to the thing that we actually need school funding for, which is providing safe learning environments in our public schools for the people who are in our public schools who are students who don't want to get coronavirus. So that was also a non-starter for Dems because it's just a school choice funding operation. And then it included $16 billion for testing and $31 billion for vaccine and therapeutics development. But it didn't include a lot of important Democratic priorities like money for state and local governments who are basically having to bankroll all of this because the federal government's MIA. And then, you know, also federal governments are, I mean, state and local governments are furloughing workers themselves, which means that we're going to have fewer services available to us even as we see an increased need for a lot of those services. So,
yep.
I mean, this is a mess. Also, it didn't include any stimulus checks, which is like the only reason to have a bill
right before the election. I saw something online the other day that I think that the stimulus, that $1,200 stimulus check, I think at the point we're at in this right now, since we those checks started going out, comes out to like $6 a day.
Right, there was there that meme that was like, for $6
a day, you can sponsor an American.
And then Sarah McLachlan said, if you need me to write a song for this, let me know, for the PSA. You were given $6
a day, by the way, not enough to live on.
Not enough to live on. Not even enough to eat on. Have you tried to buy a sandwich recently? I mean, not even close.
No.
But so we're going to have to listen to crocodile tears all week, because Mitch McConnell's going to be crying his eyes out about how the Democrats wouldn't go for this. And then the Democrats are going to be crying their eyes out. And here's a thing. It's wild to me that they're playing this game right before the election. It's wild that the government is broken to this extent. Like, this is a really dramatic extent to see the government be broken in, because this is a really desperate emergency situation. And the fact that they can't even get together to do one thing for people who in a moment of crisis is really unconscionable.
And what is so crazy about it is that there were reports this week from both Democratic lawmakers who are up for re-election right now, whether in the House or in the Senate, and Republican legislators in both the House and the Senate, who are both urging their leadership to pass something to save them in their re-election bids. You know, we've talked a million times about all the Republicans who would be helped by some sort of like massive bill like this. Cory Gardner in Colorado might be able to weasel his way into a victory, although that's probably cooked. But like, there are Republican legislators who really want something big passed so they can go back to their constituents and say, look, we passed something. And there are a lot of Democrats who really need the same thing, because like, they're going to be held accountable to incumbents right now are the people who are going to be held accountable because it's the people who are there who are not doing anything. It's the incumbents who aren't doing anything. So like, this isn't just a Republican problem to not pass. It's also a Democratic problem to not pass.
And yes, I
realize that the House has passed something. So, like, I can see that, like,
they even passed something that wasn't, like, that was not a coordinated effort with the Senate.
That was a messaging bill.
A messaging bill. All of these are messaging bills. And I get, you know, I'm just shocked. I'm shocked that they are this far off base. I'm shocked that they seem to sort of both be helpless in this situation.
Like, that's wild, right?
I'm sick of Congress being so helpless.
Yeah.
Like, it is not our job. I think about that tweet all the time, that was just like, 2020 is just a cycle of us tweeting at our congresspeople, please do something, and them tweeting back at us, please do something, forever and ever until we die. Like, this is like one of those moments where it's like, no, like, at a certain point, it is actually your job to figure something out. This is why I keep saying no one's up to this moment, because it's not our job to figure this out. This is literally what we've hired you to do. And the fact that you can't be responsive to this dramatic extent is really, I think, a sign that there's a larger broken piece here than just partisanship or just whatever. I mean, this is the government abdicating its responsibility to govern. And in a way that in a moment of, you know, intense crisis, and that is everyone's responsibility. That is not just, I know that it's difficult because Mitch McConnell is being an impossible person.
Yeah.
I also know that there are other members of the Republican caucus, though, who are actually empowered to get over this roadblock and are choosing not to.
Yeah.
I know that there are Democrats who are probably empowered in that they have a majority in, you know, the House and are so close to having a majority in the Senate. There are Democrats that are empowered to do something here too. Like, don't let your members of Congress tell you they're actually powerless in this situation. This is a social dynamic. It's not a real problem. Like, they need to just fucking get over it.
Yeah.
And the idea that they are feeling this helpless and are imposing that helplessness on us, people who are like starving and losing homes out here, is really unconscionable. I mean, I would contend that not a single one of them deserves their jobs back.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, in this moment, and that includes some of the people that I like. I just, like, I don't understand why no one is doing anything.
I know.
Like, I do understand, but I also, as I've said before, this is a moment that is calling for a special kind of courage. And the fact that no one is exhibiting that kind of courage, and the only Republicans who have that kind of courage are using it to resign instead of speak up, is a sign that something is really, something bigger is broken than just, you know, politics.
Yeah, I agree. Yikes.
It's a mess, you guys. It's a mess. Yeah. And here's what isn't... Okay. The next story is a story that multiple people called me all week about to tell me they were incensed. And I'm, just for the record, going to say that if you are incensed about something Donald Trump has done, I should not be your first call anymore. Right. That's I'm out of the business. However...
Call your closest never-Trumper friend.
Exactly.
Call somebody who works at the Lincoln Project.
Call the Lincoln Project and let them know you're incensed. I refuse to accept any more shock about incensed people about Donald Trump for the rest of the year. But I do have some thoughts on how a lot of this faux outrage is working against us, which is why I want to bring it up.
Yeah.
So there was this story about this Woodward book, or this Woodward interview with Donald Trump back in February, where he seems to understand that COVID is like a real threat. And then at, you know, just after giving this interview, his administration is basically like, no, this is real. I mean, this isn't real. Everything's fake. Don't worry about it. Even though in this interview with Woodward, he seems to know that it's very deadly. He knows it's spreading. He knows it's airborne. He knows it's worse than the flu. Like, he admits all of these things.
He had clearly been briefed on it and had, for once in his life, processed what he had been briefed on.
No, I'm going to tell you exactly what happened. That's not what happened. He was briefed on it, and he did the thing that he always does right after he's been briefed on something and just parroted talking points he had just been briefed. He once came out and said that Obamacare was a great idea. He had just been speaking to Obama. And then the next day, someone else spoke to him, and he forgot.
Yeah.
He just says the last thing that someone told him. It's not rocket science. It's not even disingenuous. He doesn't... Right. He's not a man who knows what he thinks, you guys.
Yeah.
And so, obviously... He then, despite having exhibited a level of understanding about this to Bob Woodward, then turned around to the public and feigned like he had no idea that coronavirus is serious or real. And I get it, because this is fucking bullshit and, like, what a horrible thing to do. But also, are we really going to feign surprise about this? Like, he's been admitting that he's been lying to us the whole time. This tracks perfectly with what we know is going on. And well, it just sort of fed into this perpetual outrage machine. And I don't think... Because that perpetual outrage, because everyone knows what's going on. Republicans know what's going on. Democrats know what's going on. Nobody in America doesn't realize he lies all the time. So it just makes us seem disingenuous because we're always feigning this outrageous level of outrage, or outrageous, this you know, extravagant level of outrage. And it's just exhausting everybody. It's not actually gaining us any winning. We don't win. We're not gaining anything by being outraged by this. I just refuse to be shocked by his behavior anymore. Well, if we're not going to do anything, I don't want to hear about it.
Right. Well, and it's one of those things, you know, I have on CNN quite a bit while I'm just like sitting at home. And I feel like they have generally done a good job of like fact checking him in a way that I feel like, you know, probably other networks are doing. And certainly not Fox News is. But, you know, like every time he says something where he's at a press conference or whatever, where he sort of like tries to remind you of all of the good things he's done about coronavirus, where he closed the borders to China and he closed the borders to Europe and he did this and they, you know, Operation Warp Speed and whatever else, blah, blah, blah. They always immediately after he says something like that, flashback to like back in February where he's like, oh, it's a miracle. It'll just disappear. Only one person has it. No more than that will ever get it. And it's going to be over by Easter. And they run the whole package that they've had cut since March, basically, of like him lying about this. So like the idea that like he would have known something privately and said something different publicly, he's been saying different things publicly. So like the idea that like this is some sort of like real
like we finally got
shock.
Him.
I mean, yes. Is it disgusting that he did this? Yes, obviously, like, we're not trying to tell you that, like, if you want to have rage about this, then, like, it's certainly a thing to have rage about. But, like, the idea that it would be new information to someone is someone who has clearly been disconnected from, like, planet Earth for, like, the last 6 months.
And I think because it's like, a hum that's been going on this whole time, it's not actually new information. And so the fact that as this hum goes on, our reaction to it keeps being like this. Yeah. Is I think it doesn't it makes the conversation with the sort of cult members that are now, you know, that are subscribed to this bullshit so much harder. It makes everything so much harder. It uses up all of our energy on something that we can't solve because we have seen, just as we're seeing, Congress can't pass a bill to give us fucking money right before an election that would benefit incumbents if they gave us money. They're certainly not figuring out what to do about this. We're not going to do anything about it. And because we know we're not going to do anything about it, it's almost like, you know, should we reveal that this happened? Sure. But, like, this is not really news. It's just regular. And the other thing I think actually that has been bugging me about this is actually the framing of it as lying. And hear me out, because I know I'm about to lose all of you. I think one thing that I think I know, and that I think actually I agree with a lot of Trumpers on, get ready, is that Donald Trump doesn't really lie to us. His thoughts are all over the place. They don't make any sense. They're not, you know, and I think Trumpers really like that about him, and I really don't like that about him. But Trump is almost never lying to us. He is just telling us the last thing he heard, always. And so framing it as lying is also part of the messaging problem that we're having, because I don't think that Trumpers think he's lying, and I think they're right. He's not lying. I think in February he had just heard that coronavirus was dangerous, and he just parroted that to Bob Woodward, and then also someone else later told him something different, and he parroted that to the American people, and he wanted to, his inclination was to do nothing about it, and so he went with the version that involved nothing, but he had all the facts circling in his head, and he just sort of was like picking whatever one was the one that was at the top at the moment. I think one of the things that his supporters really like about him, which is confounding when you think about it, but if you don't listen to what he's saying, it's probably great, is that he doesn't lie a lot of the time. He speaks untruths a lot of the time, you know. But I don't think framing them as lies is particularly helpful to our cause. I think the bigger problem is that he is somebody who doesn't have consistent thoughts.
Yeah.
And I think it would be easier to discuss what the problem is with his inconsistent thoughts than it is to discuss the fact that he's lying.
Sure.
I just, something about the kind of like constant outrage about this kind of stuff, where it's like all the common sense stuff that we're always telling you, no, you don't even have to get proof. We know all of these things are true without proof. We know he said the N-word without proof. We know he's assaulted all these women. Like, we don't need the proof. And when we get the proof, we act like, what? And it's like, we knew he was lying about this, guys.
Well, right. That's the thing. You know, I mean, I think what it's like every time, you know, every once in a while you see like the new report, like whoever's fact checking him, like, you know, I think Washington Post every once in a while will release like how many tens of thousands of lies he's said or whatever. And sure, yes. But like also, and what? I mean, like, that's what I was going to say. It's like, then, you know, the only thing that we can do sort of at this point, because we haven't done anything about it, is basically just like vote him out. But until then, it's just like the rage that you're sort of like, you know, save yourself.
Well, it's save yourself. Right? And then also, if you have that kind of energy, devote it to some sort of action.
Right.
You know, let it drive you to do something. Don't just be caught in an outrage cycle about a thing you already knew.
Yeah.
Like, nobody has time for this. It's like too many things are going on.
Yeah.
It's just like it's an unproductive use of energy. I think, I don't know.
If it's going to affect your own sanity, then like, don't let it do that.
Well, I think some people get off on the adrenaline of of this, but I don't, so don't call me about it. If you're shocked by something Donald Trump did, don't call me.
Right. Leave me alone.
Leave me alone. If you have an idea about a thing that we could do to hold him accountable, then great. Let's talk. But I think this one in particular, this was like the Trump shock story that like, where I like reached my limit, where I was just like, oh, I'm filled up on rage at Trump. Like, I don't actually want to hear about this.
Right.
Like, are you telling me we're going to do something or no?
I've been knowing this since March.
Right. So I hate when someone gets really incensed about something we already knew.
Right.
It just seems like what a waste of time, you know?
Yeah.
If Donald Trump does something that you find horrifying, just know that you already knew he was a horrifying person.
Right. So and don't call Lila Nordstrom.
Don't call Lila Nordstrom. But any action that he takes in additional horror is actually consistent with the behavior he's been exhibiting, so it shouldn't shock you. There is no bottom to him. It's like I don't know what we're thinking we're gonna find. There's no bottom to it. So
This is a man who at one of his rallies this week played the song "Fortunate Son," which is about draft dodging.
That's right.
Rich people draft dodging.
Well, it was a perfect song for him to play because that's exactly what he did. A little CCR, a little walk down memory lane about the time that he had bone spurs.
Yeah.
And look, I'm not here to even in my opinion, everyone should have dodged this draft.
Right.
So I'm not even here to judge that.
The week after his latest scandal was talking about how the troops were losers.
I was going to say, where I judge him is in that he doesn't seem to think this was a thing that should have been afforded to everyone.
Yeah.
And also thinks that the people that did serve are losers and suckers. That's a man who shouldn't get away with his fake bone spur diagnosis.
No.
And certainly, what a campaign fail. Who runs his campaign? His campaign is like Looney Tunes. I know what is going on. Well,
but like, wasn't this pointed? Like, they've done shit like this before, right? I mean,
I guess I have a feeling that no one listened to the lyrics. I bet it sounded like a folksy fun song.
But have you been playing it before? Like, I just have a lot of
questions. They played it like five times or something at this rally.
Yeah, I don't know. Something about it feels gross.
It's gross. But I have a feeling that it sounded like the sound. It's like accidentally playing a Dixie Chicks song because it sounds like a country song and then finding out it's anti-war. Like, it's like the kind of mistake that gets made periodically by idiots who just are like, well, this sounds folksy and fun. And then some 25-year-old who was in charge of the list, you know, didn't know that the lyrics of the song are about draft dodging because they don't remember the Vietnam War.
Right.
Because they're 25. Well, I don't know.
Could be.
I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt in that I think that it was incompetence and not pointed.
I'm going with the more nefarious storyline.
If you want it to be nefarious, I'm willing to entertain it. I mean,
yeah.
I don't see why not.
Yeah.
Also, Trump's been nominated for a Nobel Prize.
The what? What did you say?
Nobel Prize.
The Nobel
Prize. The Nobel Peace Prize.
What's that?
It's a prize for people that are favored by far-right politicians in Norway to be celebrated by the international community for their nobility.
Oh, my God.
In the face of...
This happened once already.
Nobel crisis.
Right?
Yeah, well, so in 2019, there's this far-right politician in Norway and a friend of his who decided to nominate Donald Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize, the real one, the Nobel Peace Prize, for the talks with North Korea that we know were so wildly successful.
Yes.
This year... They are they're nominating him for his efforts to deal to make a deal to establish diplomatic ties between UAE and Israel.
Right.
These are both bullshit things, but they declared that he had created peace in the Middle East or something. Mm-hmm. And this Norwegian politician, by the way, is like part of the far right populist party, Progress Party. And
yeah, well, I think we've talked about the rise of that.
Right, he's very anti-Islam, very anti-immigration. He's going on, you know, he's always saying mean things about Muslims and whatnot.
Yeah. Talking about cultural Norwegians.
Exactly. So ridiculous. That's such an un-Norwegian thing to say. This is like people that are celebrating a man who came in second in a skiing race because he broke his ski pole. Or tied in a skiing race after breaking his ski pole. Like, this is not proud people. Being culturally Norwegian is not a thing that you're supposed to take pride in. It's just supposed to be a thing that is. So in any case, this is such a weird concept. But in any case, the Trump campaign got very excited, obviously, and made a huge ad buy on Facebook and Instagram for congratulatory ads, all of which misspelled the word Nobel as noble.
As noble.
So... they had six ads. They paid hundreds of dollars, and their ads were all proclaiming that things like he had achieved peace in the Middle East. They're all inactive now, but every single one of them was congratulating him for being nominated for the Nobel Prize. Uh-huh. And then, this is not the only time they've made this particular typo, because in April, Trump also misspelled the Nobel Prize in some Twitter rant about the media. And then in true Covfefe style, deleted the post and then claimed he was being sarcastic. But obviously Twitter loved this. The problem is that the jokes write themselves so aggressively that the joke is almost too obvious. So they weren't even that funny, because even though every funny joke about this is one you already have thought of. It was like the joke was like so obvious that you couldn't make a joke about it.
Yeah.
But
This guy.
This every time with this guy.
Telling you.
In any case, that's the news this week.
Yeah.
If you are like us in a fire zone, stay inside.
stands.
If you are not in a fire zone, it's your job to go out and do all of the things right now that we can't do.
Right.
But wear a mask.
Tell us how great and wonderful being in the world is.
Yeah. Safely. Safely. Yeah. I'm curious about how it goes.
Yeah.
And in 1 week, we'll update you about whether or not we've been able to leave our homes. Could be. Could be not.
Exciting update for you.
We don't know. Anyway, we'll talk to you then.
Bye.